On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
On The Conversation Hour today, shortly, we're going to have a look at the so-called Apex Gang, as the media in particular decided to call it. A bunch of kids ran amok in the city on the Moomba Celebration Day. Most of them were from the Melbourne African community. Some of them were from the Islander community. They very quickly adopted a kind of almost mythical status. And Dr. Brian Williams has written a book about it, about where it came from and how real was it and what does it all mean. And indeed, he's got some interesting observations and some surprising conclusions. And he's one of my guests joining us, along with circus director Sebastian Hunter. And those are our guests between now and 12 o'clock on The Conversation Hour today. My co-host is an advisory board member of Melbourne's Social Equity Institute, lawyer, community advocate, commercial litigator, Nyadal Nguyen, who's also been, I might say, much decorated and rewarded and recognised for years of consistent work representing and being an advocate for Melbourne's African community. Nyadal, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to The Conversation Hour. Your story also features in a new book that's just been published, I saw. It's called Growing Up African in Australia. It's edited by Maxine Benaber-Clark. Do tell us your story. How did you come to be in Australia?
I got here in 2005 in what felt like a very cold day actually in Melbourne, but looking back right now, I've had much colder days since then. I still haven't got used to the weather though. My heater is always about 27 degrees in the house. I'm not joking, that's the truth.
27?
Yes. I find it really cold. So 25 degrees is just a bit cold for me. I need to crank it up a bit. But I arrived here from Kakuma Refugee Camp, which is where I'd spent most of my childhood. So I started my primary school in Kakuma.
And where's that?
It's in Kenya. Mm-hmm. Just maybe a maximum of about 3 hours from the border of South Sudan and
so
Kenya.
So North Kenya, north
yes.
of Nairobi.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And why were you there?
Well, I was there because there was a conflict going on in South Sudan, which is where my parents were from, although my mom is South Sudanese Ethiopian, really. I couldn't go back to South Sudan. At some point, I got separated from my mother. I was actually born in a refugee camp, going back a little bit. I was born in a refugee camp in Itang. And in 1991, there was another war in Itang. Another war in Ethiopia. There was a civil strife in Ethiopia. And so we were displaced from Itang back to South Sudan, the southern part of Sudan. And then I don't recall how it happens, but eventually I got separated from my mom and then I ended up in Kakuma with extended family members.
And so, how many of you were there in that extended group?
Well, I recall being with another stepsister, two other stepsisters, a stepmom, and at that time I think two of her kids. Yeah. But we were some of the first families to get to Kakuma. It's still a refugee camp now, 20 years later, but at the time when we arrived, it was really sparsely populated and it's quite a flat area, so you could see quite far. And I recall returning back a few years later, a bit older, and just seeing how overcrowded it is. And it's even getting a bit overcrowded now with more people coming in from South Sudan.
And how did you get to come to Australia of all places?
My mom applied for resettlement to come to Australia through its humanitarian intake. And we were sponsored by a family member, and it took us about 3 years before we made it here. And I recall my mom thinking that was rather too long and singing gospel songs and praying at night to try and persuade God and hurry him up a bit, get it sorted. And we were lucky enough to have made it, very lucky, because very few people actually get resettled to what are considered developed countries. Majority of people end up stuck in refugee camps for 20 years or so.
How much did you know about Australia before you arrived?
Very little. Very little.
Anything at all?
No, we had, I think, an hour cultural orientation presentation.
What does that mean?
It's a presentation that's supposed to introduce you to the country you're going to, but I don't even recall much of what was discussed there. I think I was just excited. I knew it was not Kakuma. So that was one thing. And I knew that I would be able to pursue further studies, because at the time I was in what was the equivalent of year 12, and I was worried that if I didn't get out of the camp, that would be the end of my education. So it was really well timed that, you know, our approval process got through before I finished my equivalent of year 12.
Describe to me what it was like getting off the plane and finding yourself in a completely new world.
Very, very exciting. I should be, just before the plane landed, it was the contrast. I mean, that it was if there was the world had turned upside down, really, because you could look down and you would see all these scattered lights of Melbourne as the plane was landing, and it was, you know, you look up to the sky and it seemed a bit dark. Well, in Kakuma, because there was no electricity, the sky was always lit up. You could always see the stars in Kakuma because it was quite dark and there was never really electricity around. So it was a bit different. It was almost as if you're landing on a carpet of stars in a way. It was really awesome. And I remember getting out of the airport and meeting the family member that was driving us home, and we were going through the tunnel. I just kept looking at it. I mean, it's not necessarily that beautiful. It's not like the artworks there, but I just was fascinated just going through a tunnel as the lights kind of flash by. Still a memory I hold. And then we got to the family's house, and the first meal we had was a KFC. I think I must have eaten nearly a whole bucket load of KFC since that day. So it was really, really exciting. Yeah.
And how did you go from being a refugee from a camp in Africa, displaced and ambitious, to now being a commercial litigation lawyer at one of Melbourne's top firms?
I think a lot of luck and a lot of generosity from many people, and then some hard work. And I think people, when I say that, people think it's a bit of a feigned humility, but I've been tremendously lucky. I've been lucky to have survived a refugee camp, to have survived without, you know, both my parents around for a long period of time, then been lucky to have come to Australia where most of my friends didn't get same chance to resettled. And then when I landed here, I know I've had people who have been generous with their time and their advice. I've worked hard. You know, there were time, particularly when I was at Melbourne University, where I was working at the time three part-time jobs, you know, to try and just, because we came here with nothing. We didn't come here with a cent. With zero, literally, no money. And so I really couldn't rely on anybody in terms of my family for any support whatsoever.
What jobs did you do?
Oh, I did a stinty actually at ABC as an OA. And then I used to work as a research assistant for a barrister called Emres Nekvepil. And then as part of a scholarship, I had to work a few hours at the library at Ormond College. So, yeah, it was quite intense for a period. And then I also had to assist mom with my siblings on and off. And there were some tough times, definitely. And I did work hard, but I also had generous people who, you know, took me aside when things got tough, people who, you know, helped me pay for things, paid for books, people who were so generous with their advice when I didn't know how to approach a particular thing, people at the bar like Rachel Doyle, you know, so I've really, really been lucky. And then when I eventually thought I'll apply to become a lawyer, I didn't think I'll get in. I applied to three firms, actually, because I thought, I'm not going to get in. And I called Emres the night before. I was in South Sudan. I was in Kenya that day, and I said, I'm not going to apply. I'm not going to get in. And he said, you have nothing to lose.
He'd been your mentor, in a
way.
Yeah,
he's my mentor, yeah. And he said, well, you have nothing to lose when you actually apply. I mean, you can just submit it and see what happens. And I got an interview with Arnold Bloch Liebler and a couple of other firms. And it was interesting. And then I got a clerkship, which is, to me, just felt like a long version of an interview. And
like a year-long interview.
Yeah. And I think I worked really hard in my clerkship to try and demonstrate to my supervisor at the time that I really could do this. You know, I think there were some nights I was there until 8, 9 o'clock, just trying to finish an essay. And it wasn't because anyone told me to do it. I just thought, I've got so much to learn. You know, everybody seems to just get it all, seem to, you know, have a good handle of it. And I need to work extra hard to be able to just be as good as them.
And clearly that ambition, that drive is showing all sorts of rewards. So You've often been mentioned as someone who might embark on a political career.
Have I been?
Yes, a lot of people have said, oh, that's what we need. We need smart, ambitious, hardworking women coming up through the ranks who have a much more diverse approach to Australia's future.
Look, I think because I was born in a country that where democracy had failed, that I've always had an interest in politics and how, when it's done well, a society can thrive. And for that reason, I've always had a political opinion. But I don't think I have much of a political ambition. I wouldn't say that at this point in my life that's something I would consider at all. In fact,
we had Lucy Gachui in the parliament for a while.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if that worked for her, that's what she wanted to do. I truly don't have a political... I know it sounds almost like a political answer to not answer the question, but I really genuinely don't have a political ambition at the moment. But I do think, though, that the point that we need different kind of people, scientists, educators in politics. I think it's a good point. We need to diversify the political scene and the people that are making it to Canberra. I agree with that. I don't ever think that I have to be part of that to do my part in the world in terms of changing those things that I'm interested in.
Might be there's too many lawyers in Parliament already, whatever background they have. Look, welcome and lovely to have you here, and congratulations on your chapter in the book, edited by Maxine Benaber-Clark. It's called Growing Up African in Australia, and my co-host today, Nyadal Nguyen, has a chapter in that, along with a bunch of other people, some of whom you might have heard of from time to time, and others who are completely new in telling their stories. Growing Up African in Australia. It's a companion volume. There's a couple of others in the series. I'm trying to remember what they are. There's Growing Up Indigenous in Australia, and Growing Up, there's another one, Growing Up Something Else in Australia. I can't remember. I should, but that's my failing along with all the other things. Our first guest on the Conversation Hour in a moment, lawyer and author Brian Williams. He's been investigating the so-called Apex Gang phenomenon. He's written a book about it called Melbourne Under Siege with a question mark at the end, and he's our first guest. And Brian, good morning to you.
Yes, good morning. Thanks, John.
Why did you choose, first of all, to research this whole episode and then write about it?
It was probably to add a bit of balance to the narrative that had been floating around. I was aware of the incredible attention that had been put on this concept of African crime, but I was also aware that at the same time that the crime figures in Victoria and even the youth crime figures in most areas had actually been going down at about the same time. So I guess I wanted to see how the hysterics had come into it, but also to see how much of it was myth and how much of it was reality.
And what did you conclude?
Well, look, the thing that is very important to always remember in any criminal activity is that we're dealing with a lot of very traumatised victims. So, of course, for those people, this is a very real problem, and I totally sympathise with that. But across the board, what the analysis showed was that probably the hype had got a little bit ahead of the actual criminal activity that was involved. We were only talking about a very small, it was called a cohort, but a very small group of young people who had gone off the rails, and in a population of probably 11 or 12,000 people, they were a very, very small percentage of that. And we're talking about a group of people who have been magnificently law-abiding in Victoria, certainly on the whole, and so I was very concerned about that as well.
I read your book with interest, partly because, for obvious reason, this conversation was one that a lot of the Sudanese community were involved, whether you like it or not. You started off by writing about South Sudan and referring to the current conflict in South Sudan. Why did you think that was relevant? Because I'm interested to understand how much of what is happening with these kids was because they come from a particular background, and how much of it is actually the fact that they live here in Australia and the challenges that comes within Australia. So I'm interested to understand why you started off the book with quite a bit detailed take on what is currently happening in South Sudan.
Yeah, well, I certainly believe that I didn't know much about the South Sudanese community. And I was very interested into where they'd come from and the sort of experiences that they'd had. I was taken aback by that. I don't think that it's easy to understand that sort of experience unless you've lived through it. In terms of how that meshed into the book, I would think that some of the young people, and I stress again a very small number of young people who went off the rails, there was a fair bit of their background associated with that, but also a fair bit of difficulty with their time in Australia as well, and the way that they were accepted into the community, and the, whether or not they saw a positive future for themselves at that particular point. We've had some wonderful success stories. I suggest you're one of them. But a lot of the kids haven't had that same experience as well.
Do you accept, Nyadol, that there is or was such a thing as the police or the media, as much as the police, called the so-called Apex Gang?
No, in terms of it existing as a gang, I don't think one ever really existed. I think that it was, as the police has constantly described, a group of kids that actually came together to try and commit offences. But didn't really have the structure that, you know, police know that organised gangs tend to have.
Like a bikie gang.
Like all that. It was really loose associates of kids that, you know, met online and utilised the internet in a way, in a very dangerous way, to commit very horrible crimes.
Do you agree, Brian?
I certainly do, yeah. When I say that, I have studied the concept of this youth phenomenon, if you like, of pop-up crime. And it's very much based on social media, where a group of kids can, if you like, get on their phones and within a few taps assemble in a certain area. They commit a crime, then they dissipate. And so they really only come into being when that crime's been committed.
Sure. Now, I attended a conference the police convened where it was pointed out that a higher proportion of these offences were being committed by kids from the Islander community than the African community, and yet it was described as an African crime phenomenon. How did that come about?
Good question. As with a lot of things, when you're dealing with a complex matter, there's probably no simple answer to that. We're certainly talking about Islander young people as well, but there are other racial groups mixed in there, of course, including Australian as well. So it's not easy to see how it was completely turned into an African problem when, in fact, we were dealing with a number of different racial groups.
I think it was turned into an African problem because it fits into an already existing perception of Africans or black people as violent or as prone to violence or coming from really violent background. And I think that it found an established narrative in certain areas of we fed we look like very good monsters. And also, I think physically, it's very easy to pick us out. We're very tall. We're very, very dark. I certainly couldn't pass for a blonde hair, blue-eyed woman anytime soon, despite my best efforts. So I reckon, you know, we stood out. We are new. We are a small group of people that can be attacked effectively without really having much of an impact. It's not like we're such a big base that we can shift elections.
So you're an easy target.
We're
a
very easy target. Yeah, we're a very easy target. But that said, you know, I mean, a lot of people in my community were quite outright an outrage about the conduct of these young people. And I think that was really missed in the media too. We were, you know, that a lot of us were very upset and felt that what they had done was entirely unacceptable.
There seemed to be a feeling that people were being slow to admit there was a problem. And certainly from the research I did, the South Sudanese community on the front foot in terms of saying we do have a problem. They didn't have any necessary answers straight away. The other disturbing thing I noted was that this tended to marginalise a lot of the South Sudanese community. As I said, people who are very law-abiding. There was suggestions that they were being followed around shopping centres, that they had difficulty getting rental accommodation. Children were a bit scared to go to school. They felt like they were being singled out. So there was a number of aspects where it impacted the South Sudanese community as much as it impacted anyone else.
I mean, going back to your book, you talk about marvellous Melbourne quite a bit, but also mention how historically there had been all these other gangs, like the Sharpies and the rest. Yet what...
Budgies and yes, Widgies and... Widgies, was it Widgies? Can't remember now.
Yeah, Bodgies and Widgies. Bodgies being male, Widgies being female.
Mm. Sharpies.
Sharpies, skinheads.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to ask, two questions initially. The first is, I mean, considering this history and the fact that a predominantly majority of the crimes in the state are committed by Australian-born, has Melbourne really ever been marvellous? And secondly, what was the difference, in your view and in your research, between those gangs or the conduct of those gangs and the conduct of what has been termed African gangs?
Yep. Well, there was certainly the nature of the crimes being committed by some of these young people were quite horrifying and very invasive. We're talking here about home invasions and carjackings and smash and grab robberies. Those sort of
crimes. Particularly that series of them in jewellery shops, which we later learned were being commissioned by organised crime figures.
By organised crime figures, and these young people were being used as the attack vehicles, if you like.
And sometimes quite already high on ice and stuff like that.
And look, I can understand people in the community seeing those sort of crimes being committed, and there was certainly a feeling at that point that we've had gangs before, but never like this. Now, that may have had something in it, but anyone who can remember back to the skinhead and the Sharpie days would tell you that not all of them were all love and kindness either.
No.
That they did attack easy targets, that they did work in numbers, that they did get very geographical about what they did. So
there's another aspect to all of this, though, which I think a lot of us don't understand, and maybe Nyadol or from your research, Brian, you can answer this. I was talking to a very senior Victorian police officer who was on patrol on a public holiday. And this was the commander of the entire police presence on the streets of CBD Melbourne on New Year's Eve. And after they got through till about 2 a.m. without any major incident, he, from the control room, decided he'd go out on foot patrol with the rest of the police who were on duty that day in order to experience what was, you know, a significant turnout on the streets of Melbourne. He said as they were walking around, there were 8 police together with a man who is clearly very senior from all the jewellery on his shoulder. Mm. And there are a bunch of kids from the African community on the street. And he said he's never in all his policing career seen anyone so bold. Some of these kids walked up to the commander, nose to nose, eyeball to eyeball, and basically said, "What are you going to do about it?" And he said, in all of his policing career, in all of his dealing with youth offenders of any kind, any background, he said he's never met anyone who was so disrespectful of authority or so prepared to just basically say, "I don't care who you are, but I'm not taking any notice of being told what to do." I found that quite a remarkable anecdote. And that was firsthand to me from him. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the relationship between African communities and the police have always been difficult. It has never had the kind of media coverage we've had, especially during the Victorian election, but it had always been difficult. And there's some research that was done by the Flemington and Kensington Community Legal Centres that says that this relationship was, even in around 1993, when relatively small numbers of Africans were here, that it was already a tough relationship.
And there was some racial incident. Profiling and stuff.
Yes, and the case also, the Hail Michael case, document a whole series of alleged abuses by police. And so that create, particularly for young black men, a perception that the police are never on their side, and that they can never, you know, back them up. And I think when someone thinks that that person is an enemy, then they have no respect for that person's authority.
Sure, but having that mindset, which I understand what you're saying by way of explanation of the mindset, but then to basically eyeball a senior police officer with 8 other cops there on New Year's Eve and saying, "I don't care, what are you going to do?" I mean, that shows a mindset about your relationship to any authority figure.
Yes, it does, yeah.
That most of us find quite confronting.
It is confronting, but we've got to realise that we are also dealing with a group of kids that really don't feel as if they belong or to the society at all, or that they really don't think that they can rely on the police or the justice system or the judicial system. They are against these systems because they think that the system somehow either oppress them. But also, I think, you know, and not justifying the conduct, I do think that some of them I've already maybe been through the system and think like, well, I don't really care what happens to me. eventually. Maybe they don't really take the consequences of what is going to happen to them seriously enough.
Right?
Yes, John, there was definitely a feeling that the police and authorities were seeing a defiance they hadn't seen previously, and also a feeling that the persons that sometimes they were dealing with, once again a small number, had very little fear of the consequences of that sort of behaviour. And I tend to agree that...
They didn't try and disguise their face or who they were or their identities.
Very bold. Very brazen.
Very bold. Yeah. And then you spend quite a bit of time talking about the impact of American gangster or rap culture.
Yeah, certainly.
American, yeah. African, yeah. African-American street culture here in Australia. Where does...
I guess that needs to get down to going a bit deeper in this. And as I said, most of the solutions, a lot of the solutions that have been put forward are very punitive. Grab these kids, throw them in jail, and that's it. If we're going to get anywhere, we need to go deeper than that and try to look at how the kids get to be so marginalised and feeling this way in the first place. What makes gang life so alluring to them? Now, a lot of these young people have obviously, however it's come about, have felt like they're very switched off from the community. They have nothing to look forward to, and so the gang life becomes very attractive. And this idea of rap and gangsters on the internet, it starts to become a replacement for positive behaviours.
And Yadal, the other thing is, this is not exclusively, but predominantly boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Why are they so angry, and what do we do about it? I understand the anger might come from feeling outside, excluded, dispossessed, no future, no hope, no one's going to accept me here, I'll never get a go. But the women don't seem to have that attitude.
Yeah, I think if you look at crime statistics generally, young men tend to be the cohort that commit most crimes. So that's not necessarily unique to say South Sudanese Australian. And the second thing is that we do have a very high population of young people, more than the average community. Mm-hmm. So in that instant, the level of criminal activity within our community, because of the high number of young people, is also probably going to be a little bit high. And there's a question whether that over-representation disappears when you consider that factor, that the fact that South Sudan is about 50% of our population being young people, where it's about 30% for the rest of the population. I might be wrong on those stats. But
and what do we do with this? How do we work on this anger that seems to drive so much of it?
I think the way we work through alienation and anger through a group of all young people from a different background. Now, there's a part, and when people talk about the African gang, we see the colour, we see the background. But also, if you look carefully, some of the examples that were given, even in this book, a lot of these young people were high on drugs or had been drinking. They come from relatively poor background, had struggled in school. You know, these are patterns that are quite common across the board when you think of criminal offending. So I think that's where we target our effort now. But I also think we also need to accept that there's always in any community going to be a core group of people that commit criminal activities despite what is afforded to them. And in that instance, I think what we do is that we deal with them according to the law as it stands.
And we need to, Brian, also need to find ways of bringing these people into civil society instead of leaving them on the margin.
Give these kids a positive angle. Listen, I've had a lot to do with Les Twentyman and his foundation, and there hasn't been a foundation that's more on the ground in relation to this, and have given kids opportunities in sport, trying to get them to go back to school. They drop out of the system very early. They're all on the internet about gangsters and rap and all of this sort of stuff.
Got to give them skills and
Could
the prospect of a job.
Could I say something about the gangsters and the rap, though? I think one of the reasons why we initially had a problem in 2007, for example, where people were beginning to call kids just hanging in a group together gangs, was because people automatically assume stereotypes from the US apply to Australia. Now, someone can wear the hat backward and wear a red bandana, but that is a fashion statement, not a criminal statement. And I think it's important that somehow we differentiate that. Like, I like rap music, I listen to rap music, but I have no intention of robbing anyone.
No. You know? And the other anecdote, since I'm peddling anecdotes this morning, was about a fast food outlet in the outer suburbs that was having all sorts of problems with violence in the car park and people gathering and creating mayhem and frightening off their customers. And they demanded that the police do something about it. And the police came and had a look and said, interesting. Can we make a suggestion to the proprietor of the franchise of the outlet? And they said, what's that? He said, well, we had a look, and out in the car park, there's a whole lot of kids of different and diverse ethnic communities, and they're all hanging around the car park, and yes, it becomes mayhem. And then we came inside your shop and we had a look and realised that your workforce is entirely white.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you employ some of those kids?
Exactly right.
Give some of them a job, and then the kids who are outside might realise that they're also allowed inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll change your relationship with the community. So they did. Problem went away.
Mm.
And the police were the ones who made that suggestion. It was the police who worked with the proprietor, and it was the police who said, we have to explain something to you here that was otherwise something they just didn't understand. I thought that was absolutely a stunning moment in my understanding of the issue as well.
Mm.
Look, congratulations, Brian. The book is called Melbourne Under Siege with a question mark. Melbourne Under Siege. It's published by New Holland. Brian Williams, lawyer and author, has put it all together. Niadal Nguyen from a Melbourne major law firm. She's a commercial litigator there at Arnold Bloch Leibler. She's also become a great representative and an advocate for Melbourne's African emerging African community as my co-host. We're all joined now by someone else who doesn't quite know where he fits in with things. Zeb Hunter is the director of a circus, performance coordinator for the National Institute of Circus Arts. He used to be with Cirque du Soleil and the Flying Fruit Fly Circus. Morning to you, Zeb.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, look, you just walked in here like a normal person. Didn't come in on a unicycle. You're not wearing stilts.
They're retired now, unfortunately.
Are you?
Yeah, hung up the costumes, hung up the lycra.
Instead of tight roping, what did you used to do?
So I was a trapeze artist. So I used to swing 9 metres in the air on a rope and a bar.
Which is like super scary. I've only ever watched it from a distance, and that's fine by me.
I went up on it for the first time in 2 years on Saturday. I was so afraid. My heart was like, ooh, it's been a long time, so...
Is it like riding a bike? You could still do it?
I could still do it, but I think that, you know, you definitely habituate yourself to the fear. You habituate yourself to the height and the motion. And so when you haven't done it for a while, some of the adrenaline that you initially had comes back.
So tell us about Dispersion. This is a new show. It sort of combines music with circus arts.
Yeah, so every year I have been directing the second year show at NICA, and this year...
NICA, the National Institute of Circus Arts, so it's like Circus College.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And so this year we're working with the concept of dispersion, which is quite an abstract work. We are really trying to look at... the concept that we all started in one place and we were all connected and that we are still all connected and that there is an empathy and a relationship between us that exists in the world and we're trying to explore that through a physical language.
What's it look like? What do we see?
Not sure yet. look, it's hard to explain. What we're doing is we're using the traditional circus disciplines and introducing some new ones to create visual images on stage that provide metaphorical or symbolic questions or statements on how we exist and relate to each other in the world. What are the things that bring us together and what are the pressures that we feel that pull us apart as well?
I know very little about the circus. So I'm wondering what made you interested in the first place? How did you get into this?
So I grew up in Aubrey Wodonga, which is 3 hours north of here, and there happened to be a youth circus school that was one of the oldest in the world in terms of contemporary circus schools. And contemporary circus has really only existed since the 70s. Before that, it was something that was a tradition passed down within families, and then those families would marry within other circus families, and that was how the art form was existing traditionally. And then in about the 70s, there was a big shift, a big cultural shift. And Australia was one of the places that led that shift globally in terms of starting to look at a new form of circus that took animals out of the ring, that performed in proscenium arches, in site-specific venues, and
dropped out
traveled.
The animals, got rid of the lions and the elephants.
Yeah, and that looked to create a circus that was an art form interested in saying something beyond the presentation of the skills. So it was really about looking at a way of thinking about circus as more than just entertainment. Hopefully it's still entertaining, being a contemporary form for a public, but I think it's trying to find that other layer that is art, that is interpretive.
And look, other than going to a circus, my knowledge of circuses is very limited. I'll say that straight out. But I assume that you mentioned about a circus school before. I always assumed that circus people ran away to join the circus and that they learnt on the job from someone who knew how to do it or something like that. But obviously there's a lot more in it than that, so it's really a schooling situation for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, most people start with recreational classes and they might have come originally from dance or martial arts or gymnastics or any other avenue of physical work. And then what we started to have emerge in places is the emergence of circus and aerial schools. So there are schools in Sydney, schools in Brisbane, schools in Canberra, schools in Albury. A lot of the coastal towns and cities now have their own circus schools, and we're the main feeder for people who want to pursue this as a professional career. So we have a 3-year bachelor degree and a
Bachelor of Circus.
Bachelor of Circus Arts. Yeah. So.
But wasn't circus a lifestyle, not just a skill or a profession or a trade?
And look, I think to a certain extent it probably still is. I think people are drawn to it because they want to travel, because they want to connect with people from all over the world, because they want to work with people from all over the world, and because they felt maybe a sense of, as I said when I walked in, a sense of not belonging. And so the circus was a way of creating its own community of people who felt like they didn't fit in.
Freaks, sideshow freaks was pretty much a staple of the old days.
Yeah, and I've just been working on the
two-headed
Barnum musical.
Two-headed men or bearded ladies or yeah. I don't know, what else was there?
Well, you know, I mean, to an extent that was also, like, I think we kind of look back at that now and feel a sense of horror to a certain extent that people who were disabled were taken advantage of in those situations. But I think that there's always been a curiosity for people to try and understand somebody who's different and to
make them an object of people, yeah. Well, commercialise their appearance.
You've made me think of the circus quite differently because I just honestly thought of it as a form of entertainment. But from the conversations that you've had here, talking about how, you know, the new production that you're looking at, talking about our connections, which kind of relate to broader issues of diversity and harmony. And then you mentioned how you started taking out animals, which feeds into bigger conversations as well about how we treat an animal welfare. So in your own life, what do you think people miss a lot about the circus, beside the fact that they treat it as entertainment?
Well, I think it just is that even friends that I have who have kids that have grown up in contemporary circus, still when you ask them to draw a picture of the circus, they'll draw a tent or a seal or a clown, or we still have these tropes that exist within our society of what the circus is. So I think to a certain extent what we're trying to do is not at all disrespect that heritage of the form, but it's to start to question and go, what else could it be, and what is our role as artists today in society, and how can we say that with circus? How can we say that with our form?
And what occurs to me is certainly the sort of circus work you do, there's an incredible element of danger to it. It's not a trick, is it, what you're saying? If you made a normal person do that once, that would be something that they would never get over. But you just do it every day. And obviously you minimise the risk, but there's still danger involved, isn't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, I've had friends that have passed away while performing or training.
What from?
From things going wrong, from human error, from accidents.
What, trapezing?
In many different types of disciplines. So, you know, I think to a certain extent you become aware that that there is a risk, but I think that we do it so often that sometimes you forget the risk is there, and then also the whole reason why the students are there is because they love that feeling. They love the feeling of being able to do something that is otherwise thought of as impossible for most people.
Hmm. So where do you recruit from? Who are the students at the National Institute of Circus Arts? Where do they come from?
From all over Australia, and we do have some international students as well.
Is there a type? Is there a, like, I don't know, do they come out of gymnastics? Do they, kids who want to come out of the arts, the performing arts, what are they?
Yeah, it tends to be varied. So we tend to get students from athletics, or we'll get students from circus, or we will get students from gymnastics. I think the good thing about circus is that it's very different to most artistic disciplines in that we have, in ballet, for instance, everybody learns the same steps. Mm-hmm. In circus, you have an entire range of different skills that everybody learns. And so what this does as a form is make it really inclusive. So we have people that do a discipline that might mean that they lie down on their back all day. So they don't necessarily, they lie down on their back all day and juggle with their feet. So they might not necessarily need to be that physically active. And then you'll have...
Do you still do a bed of nails? Does anyone do that sort of stuff anymore?
Yeah, there are people who do contemporary sideshow. Yeah. And it's quite prolific, I think, in Australia, actually.
People used to put fish hooks in their eyes and pick up a weight and all that sort of stuff, yeah? Mm. Is that sort of stuff still going on?
See, after, you know, what my friends joke, after dodging real bullets, I don't think I have any appetite for risk-taking at all.
Which kind of makes a lot of sense to the rest of us, Nyadala. I don't blame you, but people do this. They do all sorts of weird stuff, don't they?
Mm. I mean, less so in terms of what we produce at the school. The school is really focused on contemporary art form and exploring...
A bit more upmarket.
Yeah, to a certain extent. But I think that definitely has a place. You know, we have knife throwing and dart throwing, and there was a student...
How do you practice knife throwing? Very carefully.
Yes. Well, like with anything, I think you kind of build it up in a scale. So you start with just throwing by yourself, and then you introduce the other person.
What, do you have mannequins or something? What do you do?
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, there's an object that they're throwing around or towards, and there's a technique, a certain way to throw it.
You wouldn't want to, yeah, well, that's not, they're all obvious gags, aren't they? don't need to do that. And how diverse is it? Because we've been talking about, you know, opportunities, and how there was the anecdote I told before about the fast food outlet that hadn't employed anybody from the various communities that were creating problems in the car park, and when they did, the problem went away. Do you have people from some of the emerging communities? Do you go out of your way to recruit people from other than the traditional source of recruits?
Well, NICA runs outreach programs where they will go mostly with Indigenous communities, and they will every year they go to Broome and they work with Sandfly Circus, and so we do have a part of our program which is based on social circus, and it's actually a big thing globally.
Mm-hmm.
Cirque du Soleil had its own program, Cirque du Monde, which was traveling around the world for 20-25 years doing work in communities. We struggle, I think, to a certain extent getting in diverse cultures, diverse nationalities represented in the school. We do have Indigenous students. We do have students from a lot of European descent. But I think it's something that we would love to see more of.
Sebastian Hunter is Circus Director and Performance Coordinator at the National Institute of Circus Arts here in Melbourne. Used to be with Cirque du Soleil and the Flying Fruit Fly. The National Institute of Circus Arts has got a show on called Dispersion. And if you want to know more, have a look at the National Institute of Circus Arts website. Brian Williams, our first guest, has written a book called Melbourne Under Siege with a question mark about the so-called Apex Gang. And Nyadal Nyuon from the Emerging African Communities of Melbourne has been my co-host. Brian, Zeb, Nyadal, thank you all for coming on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. This has been The Conversation Hour.